5-4-1-8-9.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, a group of mostly elderly Catholics broke into the Kings Bay submarine base earlier this year, just north of Jacksonville, to protest the Trident submarine. That's a submarine that can launch 192 nuclear warheads, causing untold damage. We're going to meet with one of the protesters in just a moment. And then later, we're going to hear some heated questioning of FBI agent Peter Strzok. There's a House hearing today into Strzok and his email exchange with his lover. We're going to hear what Strzok is telling people in Washington in just a moment. But first, one listener comment about yesterday's program on the causes of the toxic algae outbreak in Lake Okeechobee. Here's what one listener had to say.
This is Dave in Tampa. I'm listening this morning to your program about the pollution cleanup down around Lake Okeechobee in southern Florida. And I was listening to your guest talk about the need for funding for projects, cleanup projects in that area. And it occurs to me that the reason we're having the problem is we have industrial users largely, as well as things like golf courses and development as well, human development, housing. But the big polluters should be the ones to pay that cost. These are profit-making ventures, and those costs should be borne by their operations. It's kind of fundamental economics, and it's perverse that we talk about finding funding for fixing problems that are caused by profit-making ventures. They're avoiding the cost, and they're pocketing that as profit. That is the problem. And it seems to me that our legislature should address it. It doesn't, because it's in the pocket of these big industries that prevent us from passing taxes and levying taxes on products that cause the problem. That revenue could be used to clean up the problem. They don't do it because they're bought off. And that's the problem with our campaign finance system. And that, to me, is also part of this question of being a responsible citizen, is who are you voting for? Who are they taking money from? And how are they voting in terms of protecting the common, our interest in Lake Okeechobee, our interest in water, these common things that go to the quality of our lives? How are these people voting? Who are they protecting? Is it the profits they're protecting, or is it the people they're protecting?
Well, that's a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. A former FBI agent who helped lead investigations into Hillary Clinton's email use and later worked on the Russia probe is testifying in public for the first time. We're going to hear some of that testimony in just a few minutes. But earlier this year, on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a group of middle-aged and elderly Catholics somehow sneaked onto one of the most important U.S. military bases in the world, the Kings Bay submarine base in South Georgia. There, they symbolically poured their own blood on base property and hammered on equipment to protest the destructive capability of nuclear weapons carried on board the Trident submarines. One of the activists who was arrested is Martha Hennessy. She's a grandmother from Vermont. She's the granddaughter of Dorothy Day, a co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, and I spoke with her earlier today. Martha Hennessy, welcome to WMNF.
Thank you so much for having me.
Martha, could you recount for us what happened on the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King this year? What happened to you?
Well, I was arrested with six other people. We went onto the Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base, the largest base on Earth, and it houses the Trident submarine system. We are protesting the use of these Tridents. They're not there for our protection. They are there for an offensive, and we are concerned about the treaty violations that have occurred. We're also concerned about what Eisenhower said about every structure of our society is going to be impacted by this congressional corporate industry, and the potential for the disastrous rise of any misplaced power could occur, and we already have President Trump threatening to use these nuclear weapons. Not that he fully understands what he is threatening, but the Pentagon is consuming $700 billion a year of our resources, and we are questioning the legality and the morality of this industrial complex that is an offensive system, and we cannot afford it.
Just going back a bit, you went on to the Kings Bay submarine base, which is the largest in the world. Where is Kings Bay?
St. Mary's, Georgia. I mean, this is what we're dealing with, a military that is embedded right in front of our eyes without us even being aware of it. There are not too many Americans who understand how many bases there are, how big they are, how much money they're consuming, and the secrecy, the non-democratic process of how and why we build these and maintain these bases. And we are protesting the danger, the oppressiveness, the secrecy, and the waste of resources.
This is, as you say, the largest submarine base in the world. So tell me about the security on the base. Was it easy to get on?
I really don't want to talk about that because we are going to be put on trial, and anything and everything that I say is used against me, and I would rather focus on what is on that base and what the intentions are in using these weapons.
Okay, and I understand that you're facing trial and you don't want to risk anything, but could I ask, you know, what happened on the base? Could you tell us that, what you did when you got on the base?
Well, we are calling ourselves the Kings Bay Plowshares. This is a tradition that came out in the 1980s with Father Philip Berrigan. I mean, we are all Catholics. We are ordinary folks, but we are very concerned about all of this focus on security, and the real security to be focused on is the hair trigger alert arrangement that we have these weapons on.
Martha, I know you don't want to talk about how you snuck on the base, but, and I'm asking this question in all seriousness, are you young people? Do you go to the gym every day? Do you have a military background? Are you trained military personnel? Did you wear black? Did you have night vision goggles? is any of this true?
No, we are ordinary folks. We're the lame, the halt, and the blind, and we're from ages 55 to 78. And no, it doesn't take any particular training other than our devotedness to believing in God and believing in not destroying our brothers and sisters around the globe. No, we are U.S. citizens. I am descended from people from the Mayflower, if that makes any difference to the public. You know, I come from a background of pure-blooded American, if there's any such thing.
But you're not a Green Beret or a Special Ops, but you were able to get on the base.
We're pacifists. We believe in a nonviolent, faith-based, direct civil disobedience. That's where we're coming from. We're not coming from any military background. There are folks who have participated in past Plowshares actions who did serve in the military and felt guilty and felt like they needed to redeem themselves.
And your intention when you went on the base, what was your intention? What did you want to show to our government?
We left an indictment indicting the Kings Bay base commander, Brian LePin, President Donald Trump, and specifically the Trident nuclear submarine program. We feel that the U.S. Constitution shows that this is not legal, what we're doing. Article 6, Section 2, speaks about these treaties that really have been put in place, and we are not abiding by them. The United Nations Charter, ratified in 1945, talks about not targeting civilians. The Nuremberg Principles, promulgated in 1945, talks about U.S. citizens or any citizens of any country, and for us as U.S. citizens, when we see our government committing war crimes, we are to speak out. There's no such thing as a good German. And we also talk about the Non-Proliferation Treaty that was in force since 1970, and we have managed to not abide by these treaties. The UN has recently come up with another treaty to prohibit the use of nuclear weapons. And so we leave this indictment to be studied. We also left a book called The Doomsday Machine by Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers, and that clearly lays out his experience. He was a nuclear war planner. We are willing to obliterate half the Earth's population. So we left those kinds of things. We also poured our own blood as an act of reconciliation and an act of contrition. We don't want to spill other people's blood, and following in the footsteps of Jesus. And we also symbolically hammer on these weapons systems as a way to reflect Isaiah 2. We shall beat our swords into plowshares, and nations will study war no more.
Were you able to get close to a weapon?
I don't know that.
Yeah.
So, and we also left crime tape.
Crime tape around the scene. So you went in, you committed a vandalism of a low-level nature. Would that be how you characterized it?
Or? No, the government wants to call it vandalism. I consider it vandalism creating all of these weapons and pollution. I mean, millions of people have already died just with the production, testing, storing of these weapons. So what's the definition of vandalism? If you cross over a fence, you're going to be more focused on the fence than the concentration camp that's behind the fence. So of course we're going to be tarred and feathered and, you know, brushed as vandals. But we consider ourselves religiously motivated people trying to symbolically denuclearize our U.S. military. Well, these weapons are not legal.
We're talking with Martha Hennessy, who's 62 years old. Martha, I wouldn't normally out somebody or tell their age, but I just think it's significant to this story. I hope you don't mind.
I just turned 63 yesterday.
Happy birthday. Martha Hennessy is our guest. She's the granddaughter of Catholic worker, co-founder Dorothy Day. And at St. Mary's, Georgia, just north of Jacksonville, on the night of April 4th to the 5th, she and six other people got into the naval submarine base, the Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base, and they poured their own blood on base property in a protest against the Trident submarine. So, Martha, what's so bad about the Trident submarine?
It has the firepower to kill the total world population several times over. I mean, what are we thinking here? And it's a boondoggle. It's a boondoggle, and it's a lie. I mean, the Trident system costs billions of dollars. We have a very good professor by the name of William Hartung who really studies this. And we're spending trillions of dollars. We now want to spend another trillion for a new generation of nuclear weapons. And the Trident system, there are six subs that are maintained and serviced out of Kings Bay, and they prowl the deep seas, and they can send missiles that can reach anywhere on Earth within 15 minutes and can obliterate whole cities. And we're talking about civilian populations.
Do you do this out of your religious faith?
Yes. My religious faith, but also, I mean, I'm in the milieu of America, and we're really staring ourselves in the face these days regarding white supremacy, regarding permanent war economy, regarding our history of slavery and genocide against the native peoples. And so all of these things play a role. But I get my strength from belief in a higher power that does not commit hatred and violence. And I would like to see my country be a better country. This ideal of democracy is a great ideal. And I have traveled around the world. I've seen Iranians, Egyptians, Iraqis, Russians. Many young people really admire this experiment in democracy, but we have failed, and I'm trying to hold us accountable.
So you take this out of your understanding of your Catholic faith. What do you think Jesus would do if he were here today and he saw you at the base?
Ah, Well, I don't want to get arrogant or anything, but the Catholic Church has Catholic social teachings, and Jesus lived among the least of us. He tried to show that we need to protect the most vulnerable. And in our society today, we are targeting the elderly, we are targeting the disabled, we are targeting children on the border, immigrant children, refugees we're targeting. We create these situations, and then we punish the victims. And it's all related to the capitalist system. I say Jesus would condemn capitalism. And I love the way Pope Francis said, it's the dung of the devil. So, you know, I'm not going to claim Jesus. We have people in the military claiming Jesus and inscribing on the barrels of their guns, you know, these New Testament phrases. So I don't want to be accused of being a religious fanatic. I just feel like we are behaving in a way that we are killing God. And so I'm just acting out of the primacy of my conscience.
What would you say to folks that say that the Trident submarine and all the money that we've spent on armaments over the last 60 or 70 years, it's protected us, and that if we don't spend that kind of money on armaments, we won't be protected?
We're lying. I believe that the U.S. and Russia really needs to have a security summit. And 98% of the nuclear weapons are in the hands of white Christians, the U.S., and Russia. We need to have a summit. Russia has, on several occasions, tried to move forward. Gorbachev and Reagan certainly worked together to a certain extent. But it's this corporate industrial interest that forever sabotages any kind of significant peace talks. And there's a reason why we have not moved forward, and it's not because of public concern and safety. It's because of an industry. There's billions of dollars being made. There's like so many contractors that the U.S. government employs, and it's a boondoggle. And I believe that what we're doing with NATO, the U.S. has to pull back all of its tactical nuclear weapons from Europe and the Asian part of Turkey. And let's start talking about who is the aggressor and what needs to be done to end this nuclear brinksmanship. The onus is on us, the United States.
Do you trust that President Trump, when he meets with Vladimir Putin on Monday, that they'll reach some sort of peace agreement that will be make the world a better place?
I don't trust Trump, but I really hope and pray. Trump is a businessman, and I appreciate that he met with the North Korean president. I'm very appreciative that he's meeting with Putin. I understand what his motives are, and they're not trustworthy, no.
You've been charged, along with the other members of the Kings Bay Plowshares Group, the other six members, you've been charged with conspiracy, destruction of property on a naval base, depredation of government property, and trespass. I understand you go on trial next month. How many years behind bars are you facing?
We have a trial motions hearing August 2nd. There's no trial date set yet. We're anticipating perhaps November, December. The tradition is to go pro se. We are putting forth a motion to dismiss because we feel like there is selective prosecution. We are trying to protect our religious freedom to symbolically denuclearize, and we're being charged with the same offense in four different counts. There's a lot of duplicitous indictments going on with this. And when you read out those four charges, we sound like really bad people, and that's the government's job. The government's job is to keep a lid on this system of oppression and money-making. And I am not concerned about what the charges are, and I'm not concerned with the threats that are being leveled against us. I could possibly spend the rest of my life in prison. I have eight grandchildren that I sure would love to see grow up, but that's not the point here. The point here is that I have to be concerned about everybody's grandchildren. And so let's not focus on the evil of what we did. Let's focus on the evil of the weapons.
Martha, I read a lot of newspapers every day. I read a lot online. I've seen very little coverage of Kings Bay Plowshares, of your group. Why do you think that is?
Of course. The media, the corporate media, is part of this fascist state. We like to tell ourselves that we have a democracy. We're looking at the executive branch holding incredible amounts of power. We're looking at a stacked Supreme Court. And we have a media. We're not even hearing about what's happening in Iraq after the horrible mess that we made. And we're not even hearing about Yemen, where millions of people are being starved to death intentionally. Let's have the media do the reporting if we want to call ourselves a democracy.
Well, Martha, I know you've got to get back to your grandkids. Is there anything else that you want to add about this? And could you tell us what the website is for your group, if you have one, so that people can follow and see what's happening?
Thank you. I'm sorry about my militant tone of voice. I'm supposed to be a pacifist, but there's so much at stake. The site is KingsBayPlowshares7.org. Thank you ever so much.
Martha Hennessy, thank you for coming on WMNF.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's Martha Hennessy, who's a grandmother. She lives in Vermont, but she was down in southeast Georgia on the night of April 4th of this year. And somehow she snuck into the largest nuclear submarine base in the world, Kings Bay. And she symbolically damaged some of the property there with her blood and the blood of her six co-activists. Hennessy is the granddaughter of Dorothy Day, a co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. And they are collectively called the Kings Bay Protesters. Well, this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM, and our we're going to open up the phone lines in a few minutes. We're going to try to see what's happening in Washington, D.C. There have been some heated hearings this morning. A former FBI agent who helped lead investigations into Hillary Clinton's email use and later worked on the Russia probe is testifying in public for the first time. Peter Strzok was removed from special counsel Robert Mueller's team following the discovery of derogatory text messages about Donald Trump. Mueller's investigating potential coordination between Trump's presidential campaign and Russia. Strzok tells a joint House panel today that his work was never tainted by politics. He made an opening statement about an hour ago. He's been the subject of a lot of conspiracy theories. The hearings are going on right now in Washington, D.C. The chair of the committee is Bob Goodlatte, a Republican. Jerry Nadler is the top Democrat on the committee. They're frequently at odds during this hearing. Let's check in and see if anything big is going on right now. There's some discussion about whether or not Strzok can answer some questions. Strzok says that he can't answer questions about an ongoing investigation. Let's listen in.
Votes aye. Mr. Comer.
Yes.
Mr. Comer votes yes. Mr. Mitchell. Mr. Gianforte.
Yes.
Mr. Gianforte votes yes. Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings.
We can't hear you.
No. Mr. Cummings votes no. Ms. Maloney.
No.
Ms. Maloney votes no. Ms. Norton.
No.
Ms. Norton votes no. Mr. Clay. Mr. Lynch.
No.
Mr. Lynch votes no. Mr. Cooper. Mr. Cooper votes no. Mr. Connolly.
Nay.
Mr. Connolly votes nay. Ms. Kelly.
Nay.
Ms. Kelly votes nay. Ms. Lawrence.
Nay.
Ms. Lawrence votes nay. Ms. Watson-Coleman. Ms. Watson-Coleman votes no. Mr. Krishnamoorthy.
No.
Mr. Krishnamoorthy votes no. Mr. Raskin.
No.
Mr. Raskin votes no. Mr. Gomez. Mr. Welch.
No.
Mr. Welch votes no. Mr. Cartwright.
No.
Mr. Cartwright votes no. Mr. Desaunier.
No.
Mr. Desaunier votes no. Ms. Plaskett.
No.
Ms. Plaskett votes no. Mr. Sarbanes.
We're listening to a vote right now. I'm not sure what it is, but this is
Mr.
the
Chair,
House Judiciary Committee in Washington, D.C.
Mr.
Gowdy passed.
The clerk will call the
passes
roll.
Passes not a vote.
The clerk of the Judiciary Committee will call the roll of members who have not yet been recorded.
Mr. Issa?
Yes.
Mr. Issa votes yes. Mr. Gowdy? Mr. Buck?
Aye.
Mr. Buck votes aye. Ms. Roby? Mr. Rothfuss?
Aye.
Mr. Rothfuss votes aye.
This is the testimony. We're listening to a vote on some aspect of the testimony of Peter Strzok, the FBI agent who helped lead investigations into Hillary Clinton's email use and later worked on the Russia probe. He's testifying before a House committee in Washington, D.C. And earlier in his testimony, when he opened his testimony and was being asked some questions by a Republican member, he refused to answer a question about the contents of the investigation into Russia and President, then-candidate Trump.
If they're on both committees. And the clerk of the Oversight and Government...
Mr. Chairman, point of order. On what basis would that rule be, since each committee is voting separately on that?
Procedurally, we have agreed to one unified vote. The clerk of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee will call the roll of those members who have not voted.
All right. We're going to, if and when the testimony resumes, we're going to go back to it during radioactivity. But let's open up the phone lines and take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. David writes this email. He says, I was disappointed but not surprised that Trump's apparent real motivation for getting NATO members to increase military spending is to help out U.S. defense contractors. Trump doesn't just kiss the ring of those defense contractors. He slobbers on it. What a disgrace. I can't stand these Trump supporters, writes David. That's part of his message. Mark writes this regarding the comment that you played at the top of the show. The caller's name was Dave. He made some good points, writes Mark, about the financing of the water cleanup. I tend to look at the big picture, black and white picture of all situations. I would go to the source and ask, why are the companies, golf courses, and homeowners associations allowed to dump toxins in the first place? That's the genesis of the problem. We know that are causing destruction, and yet it goes on. Why? Those are situations that I just can't rationalize, writes Mark. Yesterday, my guest, who was a scientist with the Audubon Society, said that much of the problem in Lake Okeechobee comes from the agriculture that rings the lake. So a lot of the citrus operations and cattle operations were sending their effluent into Lake Okeechobee, and that was one of the biggest causes. He also talked about the straightening of the Kissimmee River and the lack of wetlands to filter the water going into the lake from the north. He said that's a problem. That's got to be restored. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. We're going to try to go back to the Strzok testimony before the House Judiciary Committee in a moment, if that testimony continues. I can tell you that the first 20 minutes or so of that testimony, there were fireworks. It was electric. So maybe they'll replay some of the highlights tonight on the news when you watch TV at night when you go home. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Bill Grace is our phone producer today. Let's go to John in Port Richey. John, you're on. What would you like to say?
Two things. I want to go back a show and talk about Jeff, who him and I had a little conversation there on the air. And this goes to my anecdotal evidence that you really can't have a logical discussion with people like Jeff, because they tend to look at things in generalities. Like, he made the comment that Sean Hannity was the same thing as Rachel Maddow, and he mentioned some other people. And yes, he's correct. In general, they both give opinion, and they both are biased to whatever political beliefs or whatever they want to be, or seem to be, at least according to him. So that's the generality. But when you go in and do a little, in-depth analysis and do some comparative analysis, you see the difference between the two. And one was Sean Hannity was out stumping for a person, where neither or any of those people that I've ever heard of or listened to have never done that. I've never seen Rachel Maddow out there stumping for a candidate. Now, I don't listen to them a lot, so I don't know if they've actually came out and said, vote for a candidate, but I have heard Sean Hannity say, vote for Trump. So there's the difference between the two. But going back to your show today about this text from Peter, and I find this interesting that the right is pointing at this as a smoking gun, as intent to be biased towards a belief. But yet, when you look at Trump's text and his statements about his travel ban is a Muslim ban, that's like, oh, no, 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 he didn't mean that. You can't look at that in the same light. It's a different thing. So I don't understand how you kind of judge these two things differently, where one is smoking gun, what his intent was, and Trump, it's like, oh, no, no, that's not a smoking gun that he really wanted to ban Muslims. That's just rhetoric. That's just something else. So I don't understand that concept.
Well, that's an interesting point, John. I'm glad you made it. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
All right, 813-239-9663. And here's Art in Largo. Art, what would you like to say?
Yeah, hi, Rob. I was very impressed with this this lady who was pro-life, actually. And what's unusual is that as a pro-lifer, and I'm assuming she is, she's also a pro-lifer after the womb, after the birth of the child, as a pacifist, for example. And this is my main concern about pro-lifers, is that they are not interested in life after the womb. If, for example, they're not for health care for all and taking care of our elderly. And that's just my concern. And I thought she was very eloquent.
All right, Art, thanks a lot. I hope you heard my interview with the leader of the pro-life group earlier this week on Tuesday.
Unfortunately, I missed it.
You might find it interesting. I don't know if you've got a computer, but you can go back and listen on the archives.
Well, thank you.
I had a national leader of the pro-life movement.
Thank you,
Art. We're going to rejoin the hearings featuring testimony from FBI agent Peter Strzok, who helped lead investigations into Hillary Clinton's email use and later worked on the Russia probe. He's been the subject of a lot of conspiracies. Let's listen in on more of his testimony going on right now in Washington, D.C.
It is in our policy, and everything we do is dedicated to the pursuit of the facts where they lay and applying the law to those facts. There is no room for personal belief. It is something that is anathema to us. It is simply something culturally that doesn't occur, and were it to occur, it would be noted and stopped. And in addition to that culture, we have policies, we have procedures, we have laws, we have guidelines that are designed to provide outside checks and balances, to provide for outside review, to provide for any number of ways that the individual actions of any agent, any analyst, any support personnel are not acting in any way other than official policies and procedures. So when I tell you, again, as I did, personally what I believe and what I did, I understand why people may or may not have doubts or believe that. But then I would turn to you and say, look at the entirety of the rest of the organization, of the men and women who make it up, of all the things that are in place to ensure that our job in the FBI is to competently and independently pursue the facts wherever they are. And I cannot stress to you enough, that is exactly what is done day in, day out, and that is exactly what has guided my behavior for over 26 years.
All right, thank you very much. Let me ask you this. In previous testimony,
this is a question from Elijah Cummings, the Democratic congressman from Maryland.
Ray, explain the critical importance of protecting confidential human sources. And this is what he said, Agent Strzok. And I quote, "The day we can't protect human sources is the day the American people start becoming less safe," end of quote. Do you agree with that?
I do.
The problem is we now have the transcript of your 11-hour closed-door interview with our committees, and it shows that Republican members asked you repeatedly about confidential human sources involved in the Russia investigation. Is that correct?
My recollection is yes, sir.
Do you remember how many questions they asked you about that?
I do not, sir.
Let me read one of their questions from the transcript. One Republican member asked you this question, and I quote, "In the month of July, was there any information from confidential human sources given to you as it relates to the Russia investigation?" End of quote. Do you recall being asked that question?
I do.
That question was specifically about information from confidential human sources in the Russia investigation? Obviously, you cannot answer the question, and that is because the Department of Justice has a long-standing policy against revealing information from confidential human sources during an ongoing criminal investigation. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Will the gentleman yield?
I will yield if I, at the end, I want to finish. And that is what Director Wray was talking about when he testified that revealing those sources or their information will make America less safe. Is that right?
I don't know why Director Wray said that, but I agree with the statement.
In your experience, how dangerous could it be to reveal the identity of a confidential human source?
Extraordinarily dangerous.
Will the gentleman yield to his friend?
Of course.
I thank the gentleman. I want to be clear, since the gentleman from Maryland, who is my friend, is going along a line of argument that would suggest a question asked by me. I want to make it perfectly clear. I ask if you talked with confidential human sources. I never asked for a name, nor would I ever ask for a name of a confidential human source. I appreciate it. I'll yield back.
I don't think I said that. But anyway, thank you, gentlemen. Disclosing the identity of a confidential human source could create a risk to that person or our national security. Is that correct?
Yes.
What effect could revealing a confidential human source have on the FBI's ability to recruit or retain human sources in the future?
I think it could and is having an extraordinary impact in that people who come to the FBI with information are putting themselves at risk, anywhere from risk of their job, risk of their life, and they trust and put their, literally and sometimes lives, in the hands of the FBI. So when they observe, if their identity is putting at risk, clearly that's a personal risk to that individual source. But every other potential source out there, every other person in Washington, D.C., or Beijing, or Moscow, wondering about approaching the FBI to give them information, is going to look to how well or how poorly the FBI protects their information and protects their identity as they weigh whether or not to take that extraordinary risk to work with the FBI and to work with the United States of America.
Mr. Strzok, the Inspector General's report criticized your political text messages and raised concern that your political views may have impacted your decision in the summer and fall of 2016 to prioritize the Trump-Russia investigation over the reopening of the Clinton email investigation. I understand from your transcribed interview with the committee that you dispute that finding.
I do.
You told us during your interview that you immediately assigned agents to follow up on the Wiener laptop. And we know that you were a key player in the FBI's actions, such as sending a letter about the reopening of the Clinton investigation shortly before the election that clearly hurt Secretary Clinton's candidacy and benefited candidate Trump. But more importantly, you described during your interview that you believed Russia's attempts to interfere with our election pose a grave threat to our national security. You stated, and I quote, "I cannot think of a more grave allegation of the Counterintelligence Division, or let alone the nation, than that a hostile foreign power was seeking to clandestinely influence our presidential election." You remember saying that?
I do.
Why is the interference by a hostile foreign power in our presidential election such a monumental threat to our nation?
Well, I think when you look at the threat that represents, when you look at the threats facing the United States and what it means to protect the United States, the prospect of voting is the key core of who we are as a democracy. And there is no more important vote that we exercise as a people than the vote for the President of the United States. So when I look at the span of threats that I was responsible for, that the Counterintelligence Division was responsible for, and the FBI, the prospect of a hostile foreign power interfering and influencing the election for the President of the United States of America, I can think of few more severe or consequential threats facing our nation than that one.
And just two more questions. What could be the potential impact of a hostile foreign power successfully interfering with our presidential election?
Well, I think it's multifold. I think there is certainly, from a broad perspective, it draws into question the effectiveness and the credibility of our electoral system. It places into question the motivations and the actions of those people either who were elected or who were brought in as staff to staff that campaign and eventually administration. I think it draws into question whether or not the actions of the elected party and group of governing folks are acting ultimately in the interest of the United States, or whether or not there's the potential that those interests have been compromised in favor of that foreign power.
And finally, how is that threat made worse if the presidential campaign colluded or worked with the hostile foreign power?
I think that would be the worst realization of that potential threat. I think you would indicate the FBI, some of that's a hypothetical. I think the FBI would approach that from the perspective that if there were people within the campaign who are colluding or working with the government of Russia, that there is very little that would be of more importance to the FBI or actually the expectation of the American people that we get to the bottom of it. The American people, I think, expect that. Frankly, any presidential candidate who might have that going on in their campaign, I think, would want to know about that and have the FBI get to the bottom of it. But any actual inclusion or cooperation would be amongst the gravest threats to our democracy.
Chairman, are you back?
You're listening to the first public testimony of FBI agent Peter Strzok. This is coming to us live from Washington, D.C., right here on 88.5 FM. Long before you had interviewed many witnesses, including Clinton herself, you also appear to have been pining for the impeachment of President Trump at the very beginnings of the Russia case. Does the FBI normally make such decisions on whether to recommend prosecution or exoneration so far ahead of all the facts coming to light?
Typically, sir, DOJ makes prosecution decisions in cases.
Do they normally make such decisions and whether to recommend prosecution far ahead of the facts coming to light?
Sir, I don't think any decision, in my experience, the final decision is never made until the conclusion of the case. I think it is fair to say that in the conduct of investigations, particularly very large investigations with a lot of folks working on it, my experience is there comes a time, if you're worth your salt in the conduct of that investigation, an agent, the attorneys assigned to that will have a very good idea well before the case is concluded that there may or may not be demonstrable crimes.
Let me ask you this then. How many other cases on which you have worked do you recall opining on the disposition of the case months ahead of interviewing multiple witnesses?
I remember quite a few cases where I or agents would discuss the prospects of the outcome of the case with prosecutors as the case was going on. From the beginning of the case, talking about what crimes may or may not be relevant, as the case proceeded to identify which elements may or may not be strong or demonstrable, as well as towards the end when we were trying to shore up evidence that may or may not be there.
But and let me ask you this about that. In regard to those cases, was it normal behavior on your part to chat with colleagues in the manner you did on the Russia case about how much you despise the very person you're investigating or complimenting the person you're investigating in the Clinton case? Is that typical?
Sir, I would draw a distinction between commenting on case-related matters versus discussion of personal belief. I think those are very different matters than saying this person as a witness was not credible or this person as a target or a subject did or didn't do something. That is a very different
matter in my mind. So you could completely separate out what your personal opinion is from what you discussed with others in investigations?
I am telling you, sir, I separated out my personal belief from any action.
But you did not do that with regard to Attorney Page, who was also involved in these investigations.
Sir, I disagree with that. I separated out my personal beliefs from any action I took officially as an FBI agent every day.
Do you recognize
these questions are coming from Bob Goodland, a Republican, who's the chair of the committee?
Never approach the case in a fair-minded manner.
Sir, of course I appreciate that. I understand.
So let's discuss a text that hits home for me. On August 26, 2016, you texted Ms. Page, quote, just went to a Southern Virginia Walmart. I could smell the Trump support. And smell is in capital letters, all capital letters. What does Trump support smell like, Mr. Strzok?
Sir, that's an expression of speech. I clearly wasn't smelling one thing or the other. What I was commenting on is living in Northern Virginia.
What does that mean?
What I meant by that was living in Northern Virginia, having traveled 100 and 150 miles south within the same state, I was struck by the extraordinary difference in the expression of political opinion and belief amongst the community there.
And you described that as smell in capital letters.
Sir, that was a choice of the quick choice of words in a text.
All right. So earlier,
seen or heard.
Okay. So earlier, you had texted Ms. Page on that another part of Virginia, Loudoun County, which is, I think, in Northern Virginia, is, quote, still ignorant hillbillies, end quote. Is that what you meant?
No, sir, not at all.
That you consider Trump supporters to be ignorant hillbillies?
Not at all, sir.
What did you mean by that?
Well, sir, the first thing I'd tell you is a proud Fairfax County resident, there's a healthy sort of competition between Fairfax and Loudoun. Second thing I would tell you is that in no way did I or do I believe any resident of Loudoun County or Southern Virginia or anywhere else in the nation are any of those things. That was a flippant text.
So do you understand the implications of this text when my constituents in Virginia read it?
I do, sir. And I would ask you to tell them that was in some cases, certainly unfortunate use of words that in no way do I believe that those things are
what. Now, you and Ms. Page used personal phones and accounts to communicate. Have you turned over those communications to the Inspector General?
No, sir.
If not, why not?
Sir, they asked, and working with my attorney, the Inspector General, and I arranged an agreement where I would go through my personal accounts and identify any material that was relevant to FBI business and turn it over. It was reviewed. There was none, and my understanding is the Inspector General was satisfied with that action.
We know from text that you and Ms. Page would transition to iMessage and Gmail. Who determined that messages were only personal in nature and not business-related, especially since you've just testified at length that a number of the communications that you have made on government communications devices were personal in nature?
Sir, the broad context of what I used personal email and phones for was personal communication. For those things that were work-related, almost universally that material was translated into FBI systems. Certainly if it was anything that was a record or would constitute needing to be there, it was provided, but I made that decision.
So let me ask you this. When did Attorney General Lynch know that charges would not be brought against former Secretary of State Clinton?
I can't answer that question, sir. That's something you'd have to ask her.
Do you know whether it was prior to Lynch's announcement that she would defer to career prosecutors and Director Comey on whether to prosecute?
Sir, I don't know.
Clinton. Why would Lisa Page text that Lynch's decision was a, quote, real profile in courage since she knows no charges will be brought, end quote?
So that's a question you have to ask her.
So how did you take that statement when she texted it to you?
The way I took that, sir, is that we had for many months working with a team of career attorneys in the Department of Justice, a team of attorneys from the Eastern District of Virginia, a team of agents from the FBI, been working intensively on this case. We had gone through mountains of evidence, tons of interviews, and we were looking at the various statutes that might apply to any sort of criminal conduct. And I think we were, as we surveyed that, as the attorneys looked at it, saw a number of very fatal areas where elements of the crime were lacking, our ability to demonstrate facts to prove those elements of a crime. So I think we had begun to arrive at a sense that it was going to be difficult, if not impossible, to identify any statute where we could satisfy those elements of the crime. My assumption certainly is that, from the Department of Justice's perspective, those line attorneys were briefing their supervisors, who were briefing their supervisors, who were ultimately briefing the Deputy Attorney General and the Attorney General, and that she would have that same sense that it was a difficult, if not impossible, proposition to conclude that there were viable charges to be brought against Secretary Clinton.
Mr. Strzok, did you ever believe these texts would become public?
I did not.
Given that, you felt free to express your true feelings, didn't you?
I suppose, yes. That's a difficult question to answer.
Mr. Strzok, former Director Comey played judge, jury, and exonerator in the Hillary Clinton investigation. In your experience at the FBI, have you ever seen the FBI director make the decision on whether to prosecute for the Department of Justice?
Mr. Chairman, I would not agree with that characterization of Director Comey. And in answer to your question, I have not seen it before.
All right. Was that appropriate, what he did, to hold a news conference and publicly announce the decision that was supposed to have been made by the Department of Justice?
Sir, that was his decision. I don't...
Was it appropriate, in your opinion?
Sir, I don't think it's for me to say whether or not...
I think it is for you to say. I asked you the question. What's your opinion?
Sir, I understand the variety of factors that went into... Well, I understand some of the factors that went into Director Comey's decision to make the announcement. I can tell you that that decision was not made lightly at all. I can tell you my experience in that decision...
But you're not aware of any precedent for that.
I'm not.
Mr. Strzok, in a footnote 197 of the Inspector General's report... It is noted that, quote, supervision of the Russia investigation was briefly transitioned from Strzok to another counterintelligence division, DAD, in early 2017. Why were you transitioned from the Russia investigation in early 2017?
Sir, let me see if I can answer that question without getting into operational detail. The investigation was brought. What Russia was doing against our country encompassed a variety of things. There were actions in the cyber arena. There were actions by their agents and their intelligence services. There were actions by subjects of investigation that are currently ongoing. The prospect of how the FBI would investigate that was a multi-tiered effort. And so some of those efforts that traditionally fell into line with that other DAD and their span and scope of responsibility were moved to their supervision.
So the footnote goes on to state that, quote, however, AD Priestap told us that FBI leadership decided to keep Strzok involved in the Russia investigation, and he was therefore reassigned back to it. Do you know who in, quote, FBI leadership, end quote, decided to keep you involved in the Russia investigation?
I do not.
Could it have been Deputy Director McCabe?
Sir, I do not know.
And when were you assigned back to the Russia investigation? And when you were reassigned back to the Russia investigation, were you still in a supervisory role?
Sir, I would answer that question again. I don't entirely... My recollection does not comport with the statement from AD Priestap. There were elements of the investigation that stayed under subordinate leaders and subordinate section chiefs and unit chiefs on down the line. There were elements of it that were transferred to a different DAD and remained with that DAD. So my recollection is a bit different from AD Precepts.
Mr. Strzok, did you ever consider recusing yourself since you had such personal disdain for the person you were investigating?
I did not.
Yet others did require that ultimately.
Sir, I would not characterize those decisions as subject to the same set of considerations.
You don't think that it was the bias expressed in your text messages that caused Mr. Mueller to remove you from the investigation?
I do not think that that bias was expressed in those text messages. I cannot speak to why Director Mueller chose to remove me from the investigation, but I can tell you that those text messages are not indicative of bias.
Mr. Mueller never told you why you were being removed?
My recollection of the discussion was he mentioned the existence of the text messages, and that based on that, he needed to ask me to return to the FBI.
You've been listening to the testimony of FBI agent Peter Strzok, who helped lead investigations into Hillary Clinton's email use and later worked on the Russia probe. He's testifying right now before a joint House committee in Washington, D.C., and you've been listening to the hearings live. Well, that's all the time we have today. If you want to comment about anything you've heard here for the past hour, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record a comment. on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Midpoint program. Today we've got the Surly Feminists hosting another program today on Midpoint. That's coming up in 5 minutes. We'll get the latest news from NPR in just a moment. This is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. I'm Rob Lori, and stay tuned for the latest news from National Public Radio.